call this first meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:04 p.m. on Friday, January 28, 2011. Present today we have Representative Keller, Representative Holmes, Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Thompson. Let the record also reflect that Chair Gatto is back in his district and cannot be present. Therefore, he has asked me to chair the House Judiciary Committee until his return. The committee secretary is Susan Rial. Also staffing the committee is Sarah Munson. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear overviews from the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska court system. Committee members should feel free to ask questions as they arise. We will begin today's overview with Department of Public Safety. Here in the room today is Commissioner Joseph Masters, Colonel Millard of the Alaska State Troopers, Sue Stancliffe of the Department of Legislative the Department's Legislative Liaison, and Laureen Morton from the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Also online from headquarters in Anchorage are Director Oren Dime of the Crime Lab, Executive Secretary Cassandra Byrne, Administrative Services Director Dan Spencer, Director of Statewide Services Kathy Monfreda, Kelly Nicolello from Fire and Life Safety, Director of Alcohol, Beverage and Control Board Shirley Gifford, Colonel Gary Folger of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, and last but not least, Captain Hans Brink, Bureau of Highway Patrol. Let the record also reflect that Representative Grunberg and Representative Lynn are also present.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. By the way, a background on your desk is a brief biography of Commissioner Masters. Commissioner Masters, thank you for your exemplary service for the state of Alaska. Please come to the table and begin your presentation to the House Judiciary Committee. Please state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee, for allowing us to give an overview of the Department of Public Safety. My name is Joe Masters, M-A-S-T-E-R-S. I'm the commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the introduction of all of the folks from our department that we have online or in the room that are available for questions from the committee members as they may arise. I wanted to start out by requesting, with the permission of the chair, if I can have Colonel Mallard join me at the table.
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the bulk of the questions generally come in from the direction of AST issues, so I thought it was beneficial or would be beneficial if Colonel Mallard joined me at the table. Also, I wanted to take the opportunity to introduce Colonel Mallard to not only the committee, but those that may be online or that may be on video. Colonel Mallard was appointed as director of the Alaska State Troopers in December and has been in this position pretty much just over 30 days, so he's fairly new to the position. However, he is not new to the department. He's been with the department for 14 years and came from the Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement, where he served as the commander, and also prior to that served in rural Alaska. Started his law enforcement career actually down in the lower 48, where he was a deputy sheriff. Came to Alaska, worked in his first police department or law enforcement job in Alaska was out in the Pribilofs at St. Paul Island, and then we were able to steal him from that department into the troopers.
Welcome, Colonel Mallard.
Thanks, sir.
May I ask, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Where were you deputy sheriff?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it was in Idaho that I was deputy sheriff, near the Capitol.
Near Boise?
Yes.
Southern Idaho?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before I start the presentation, generally I'm fairly soft-spoken, and I've in past committees had issues with the mic. I just wanted to double-check, make sure we're okay on the microphone. Thank you. We prepared to help us along in the presentation a department overview PowerPoint presentation, and I prefer to go through these page by page rather than have them up on a screen, and I can refer to mine, and each one of you have one in front of you as well. The way this presentation is laid out, that the The second page of the document outlines the Department of Public Safety's divisions and boards and councils. And on the top of each of the division pages and on top of the department page, I put the mission of the department as well. So, for example, the Department of Public Safety, on the first page, the mission of DPS is to ensure public safety and enforce fish and wildlife laws. And each one of the division pages is laid out similarly so you can view and see what that mission is for each of those departments. The Department of Public Safety, real briefly, is divided into several divisions. The Division of Administrative Services, the Division of Statewide Services, and the Division of Fire and Life Safety, which is the Fire Marshal's Office, commonly referred to, the Division of Alaska State Troopers, and the Division of Wildlife Troopers, Alaska Division of Wildlife Troopers. We also have administratively housed within the Department of Public Safety several boards, and those boards are the ABC Board, Alcohol Beverage Control Board, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the Alaska Police Standards Council, and the Alaska Fire Standards Council. These councils and boards do not report directly operationally to the Department of Public Safety's Commissioner, but they're housed administratively, so we assist them with all of the administrative functions of state government and what's required for procedures and so forth. The priorities of the Department of Public Safety, the priority programs are law enforcement patrol and investigations, rural law enforcement, domestic violence and sexual assault programs, resource protection and highway safety, and those aren't listed on your PowerPoint presentation, but those are pretty much omnipresent in the priorities as we conduct our business in the state. The Alaska State Troopers is the largest division of the department, and its mission is to preserve public peace, protect life, property, and resources. It's also the most visible agency, or the most visible division within our department, and comprises or produces most of the activity that's seen or heard or talked about. The Division of Alaska State Troopers responded to 133,401 calls for service this year. This is calendar year 2010. And as I go through the document, I prefer to use calendar year numbers for you, and the reason I've done that is because I want to give you the most recent information that we have available to us instead of information that may be 7 months old. This number of calls for service represents an increase from the prior year of about 9,000 calls. The prior year was also an increase of calls as well. So there's an upward trend on the number of calls for service that the Alaska State Troopers respond to. And although I don't have the specific number in front of me to testify or give you, I can tell you that approximately 25% to 30% of these calls that are represented here were calls that were criminal in nature. Not all of those calls resulted in criminal prosecution, but they were criminal in nature. State Troopers investigated 18 homicides in 2010. This is an increase of the prior year. 9 of those were domestic violence related, 1 was sexual assault related. Of those, 2 were police officers from the community of Huna, a very significant event and a very traumatic event, not only for the community of Huna, but also for the law enforcement community in particular. All of these cases, with the exception of one, the perpetrators have been brought to justice. We're still currently working one of these and making progress forward on those. Homicides from prior years, both prior years, all of the homicides that were reported to Alaska State Troopers and investigated were cleared, and those perpetrators were also brought to justice. Occasionally, though, we're not able to solve homicides, and over the years, a number of those have accumulated, and also, we take an active role in assisting communities that may not have those resources in clearing their unsolved homicides, commonly known as cold cases. And currently, Alaska has 78 cold cases that the Alaska State Troopers the Bureau of Investigations, ABI, is tracking. Of those, we have 20 that are currently being worked. We have, so far with that unit, cleared 30 cold cases. 11 have resulted in arrests for first-degree murder. We've had several that have been adjudicated, I suppose, probably the best term this past year. One significant one was a 1982 killing of Tony Lister. That killer was brought to justice in 2010. A Kenai jury found him guilty in March. We also had a 1988 killing of Scott Colville, and his former spouse, pled out in that case and did not have to go to trial, but that was in November of this year that case was finally adjudicated. Currently, we are waiting to go to trial on the killer for Bonnie Craig, Mr. Kenneth Dion, and that's a 1994 case, a very high-profile and very well-known case. We thought this case was going to go to trial last year, but it's continued into this year. So what this demonstrates is that even though cases are cold, even though there may not be killers identified at the time of the killings, we still can make progress in clearing these cases and bringing people to justice, and we're going to continue that. Last year, up until last year, we had funded the cold case unit utilizing federal funding. That was through grants last year through the legislative process and finance. That funding was made permanent into our operating base budget, so it's something that we're going to continue permanent. Also wanted to mention marijuana grow operations. We had 75 cases this past year. Prescription drug cases, we're seeing an extreme increase in the number of diversion of otherwise legal prescription medication for illegal purposes, primarily in the area of oxycodone and those type of painkillers that are being sold illegally. It is positive to say that our meth labs, which have been a big problem for us in the past, have maintained at low levels. We had 11 meth lab cases that we had to eradicate or dispose of. And if you remember prior years, prior to the legislation being passed to control the precursors for making meth, we had cases in upwards of, or labs in upwards of 80 or 90 per year that we had to deal with. So I think that's a significant success, not only within our department, but also within the legislature on getting that legislation passed. Alcohol importation continues to take our time, and we're focusing on those issues, primarily to ensure that we use the alcohol laws or assist communities to use these alcohol laws to help with issues and problems and support those communities that decide that they're going to either ban the alcohol sale and possession to some lesser extent basically be a dry community or a wet community. And those communities that make that choice, we have in our department, we view that as an obligation to assist those communities. So we continue with arrests in that regard. One of the primary focuses of our department has been the continued battle against sexual assault and domestic violence. We've indicated here the number of cases that we've worked this past year in 2010, 400 sexual assault cases and 363 sexual abuse of minor cases. These are up from the previous year of 377 and 321 respectively. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're seeing an increase in victimization. It could mean that we're seeing an increase in reporting, which is something that we certainly expected to see as we bring the issue more and more to the forefront and to light in these communities. So as victims are assured and reassured that it is okay to report and that their report will be taken seriously and that will be supported through prosecution, then and that something would be done, then we expect that we will see an increasing number. So I would say that just in general terms, if we continue to see an increasing number, that can be actually considered a success and not necessarily indicative of increased criminal behavior. Now we're continuing to see increases in the number of prisoners we need to transport within our judicial services unit. I wanted to also highlight another very prominent part of our department, which people don't necessarily immediately equate with the troopers, and that is search and rescues. The state is heavily reliant on volunteers to conduct search and rescues, and not only conduct them, but also in some cases manage them. The troopers manage search and rescues as well. We had 789 of these search and rescues that were monitored or participated by the Department of Public Safety, and 389 lives are saved that were attributed to those SARs. Those are increasing numbers. And some of the reasons we're seeing increasing numbers of search and rescues is the addition or the expansion of cell phone coverage, not only around the urban areas, but also in rural Alaska areas now. It's a lot easier to call for help, so we're seeing increases due to that. We're very cautious, though, to discourage people from calling. You know, we would hope that people don't call when just because it's easy, but we also want to ensure that people will call when they're truly in danger. Another prominent part of our focus over the past several years has been highway safety. And I know that it's a particular issue among several members of the committee, and it's an issue that we take seriously. About a year and a half ago, we formed the Bureau of Highway Patrol as a specific effort to bring down the number of major injury crashes as well as fatal crashes in the state, and also provide the enforcement component for our highway safety corridors. Now, currently, we have a very tight partnership with the Department of Transportation and the Alaska Highway Safety Office, as well as other municipal agencies around the state, to help us with the effort of instituting components of the Alaska Strategic Highway Safety Plan, as well as just particularly focus on problem areas and on highways in general. We have done a number of things very specific in the area of highway safety. One of the things is the Bureau of Highway Patrol, which is almost entirely federally funded through funds that come from the Alaska Highway Safety Office. We've increased over the last couple of years the number of troopers that are dedicated in that unit, where we're at currently 27, I want to say. Is that correct?
Including the sergeants, yes.
So 27 dedicated troopers in that arena. We've got units groups of troopers or units in the Fairbanks region, in the Soldotna region, or the Kenai Peninsula, and also in the Matsu Valley. We, at the early part of 2010, stationed two troopers, Highway Patrol troopers in Girdwood as well, specifically to help us with the issues that are on the Seward Highway in the Seward Highway corridor. The number of fatalities experienced on our Alaska highways this past year for 2010 was 57. And that actually, trend-wise, is a reduction over the previous years. The last year's number was 64. The year prior to that was 62. So 57 is rough math, is about 10%. It's hard to say whether or not it's a trend at this point, but if we look at the previous years and the general trend of fatalities, it looks like and appears that the trend is that as Alaska's highways are more and more traveled, we're seeing lower numbers of fatality crashes as well as major injury crashes. We've also seen an increase in the use of seat belts. This year we had 86.8% on seat belt surveys for compliance for the seat belt law. Last year was 86, and the year prior was 84, so we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years a continued increase in the use of seatbelts. We've also correspondingly seen a decrease in the number of fatality crashes that involved someone not using their seatbelt. We had gone from 55% in 2007, 55 in 2008, down to 30 in 2009, and 30% in 2010. So that's a promising trend as well. The use of alcohol in crashes is obviously a concern, and it's a major focus for DUI enforcement. And we're also seeing a decrease in the number of fatality crashes that involve alcohol as well, where this year we had number of 28%, which was 16 of those crashes that I'd given you the number of 57. 16 of those involved alcohol. Last year in 2009, 26% involved alcohol, and the year prior was 27%, and the year prior in 2007 was 35%. Also, I want to point out that the number of fatalities we've seen this year is the lowest number that we've seen since about 1977. So it's a significant I think it's a significant accomplishment. We're attributing, although we can only talk in generalities and trends, we're attributing this to our efforts in the area of the three E's, in our efforts with Highway, excuse me, Department of Transportation, which is enforcement and education and engineering. Also wanted to, although this isn't on your slides, I wanted to point out one more thing on the from the AST side. One of the issues we have in recruitment of troopers and also recruitment of VPSOs and other law enforcement officers is the difficulty in recruiting people from rural areas of the state. This year in SIPCA, we started a program called the Law Enforcement Cadet Corps Program, which is a partnership between the Alaska State Troopers and the Academy and SITCA, as well as Mount Edgecombe High School, and which is the Department of Education, and the Department of Labor. And this partnership helped fund the startup of this program. And what this is a somewhat similar to a junior ROTC program that may be in schools, but it's law enforcement oriented and geared, and it's done over at the Mount Edgecombe High School and meetings held at the Academy with the Mount Edgecombe High School students. And what we're hoping is that in the long run, although the students at Mount Edgecombe are obviously way too young to become troopers or way too young to become VPSOs at this point, we're hoping that this exposure to 400 kids from rural Alaska will get them interested in law enforcement potentially as a career, or if they don't necessarily go into law enforcement, they may go into some other justice oriented job, or if they don't do that, at least they get develop maybe an appreciation for law enforcement. So we hope that this is going to be a very productive program, although it's going to take a number of years before we can actually see the fruits of that. So it's something that's very promising. I spent quite a bit of time on the ASD page. The next big program and thing of significance is on the next slide, and that's the VPSO program. And I'm not going to hit every bullet on this, but I'm going to hit a couple of highlights. And that is, first off, in 2008, we had 47 filled VPSO positions in Alaska. Not a very big number, and it was in 47 communities in rural Alaska. That left a lot of communities that did not have police protection or law enforcement presence in that community at the time something may occur. The governor made a very strong commitment and focus along with the Department of Public Safety that we intend on doing everything that we can to ensure that there's law enforcement presence in every community that wants one. And the governor committed adding 15 VPSO positions over the next 10 years, and that was announced last year, so we're in year two of that. There's a lot of benefit to having VPSOs in communities, and one of the strongest benefits that we saw is in a study that the University of Alaska Justice Center did on domestic violence and sexual assault cases, all of cases that were reported to AST in 2003 and 2004. And what they found was in communities that had a VPSO, that the incidence of assault that resulted in serious physical injury were reduced by nearly 40%. So that in itself is a very strong indication that having a presence in a community makes a difference. We also found when we looked at the conviction rates and the prosecution rates, particularly the conviction rates for domestic violence cases, that cases were 2.5 times more likely to result in conviction when a VPSO was present in the community when the assault occurred. Another thing we found in that study was that cases of sexual assault that the VPSOs or VPOs in those communities responded to that were eventually also investigated by the Alaska State Troopers in the region, those cases, the acceptance for prosecution rate were 3.5 times higher than when those sexual assaults occurred in a community that didn't have of EPSO or DPO. So very strong indications that, like I said, that they certainly make a difference. With some of those reasons in mind, I told you that in 08 we had 47 positions filled. Last year we reported that we had 70 positions filled, and this year in November we had 83 positions filled. The current funding that we have allows us to go to 86. So by the end of this fiscal year, we're very confident that we'll have every one of these VPSO positions filled. We don't have that much further to go to get there. The governor's additional 15 that he has in his budget request for this coming fiscal year will bring us up to 101. And we're very confident with the focus on the program and the efforts not only that AST and DPS is placing into this, but also the nonprofits and communities in rural Alaska, that we'll have all of those 101 filled if they're approved. One of the big barriers in the VPSO, or bringing VPSOs on board in rural communities, is the infrastructure that supports them. A very prominent piece that has been a barrier to communities is housing for VPSOs to live in. The governor last year put $1 million into AHFC, and that allowed communities to apply for funding under AHFC, similar to the teacher housing program, but specifically dedicated to VPSO housing. That was taken advantage of in three communities last year. The governor's got a request to put that again into AHFC's budget this year for similar support. As far as the number of cases that the VPSOs are working, last year they worked about 3,600 cases, the year prior 2,300. This year they're up about 6,000. To 6,000 cases that they're working. Not all of them are criminal. They could be search and rescues. They could be other nuisance crimes as well. But that's a number of calls to a VPSO for assistance of some kind that would not probably have been, we would not have had the capability probably to send a trooper to help these people with. So that's a pretty significant effect. This year we also have in the governor's budget a request for three trooper positions that are going to be supporting the VPSO program. We tried 2 years ago with a pilot to take one of our trooper positions in Bethel and then have that trooper specifically focus on VPSO issues, so working with the nonprofit corporations that are contracted for the VPSO program, but also the communities that want a VPSO and the communities that already have VPSOs, and work with the VPSOs themselves to try to make sure that the program is successful. And what we found in the region for Bethel, the AVCP region, if we would refer to it under this program, they've got 29 positions that are out in that region, and all 29 positions are filled. So, and that's been an area of the state where we've been regularly increasing pretty significantly, probably the highest percentage of our new positions were going out of that region. So we're very convinced that dedicating these support type positions in the capacity they're doing is making a meaningful impact on the ability to get VPSOs in the community and the ability to retain them in the communities. Alaska Wildlife Troopers, obviously their focus is resources and protection of wildlife, as well as the enforcement of wildlife laws. They also have a responsibility, which we use them for, on boating safety as well, because they're out in those areas already. We had 89,000 resource user contacts last year, and we had an additional 10,000 boating safety contacts last year. And that's significant because it gives us an idea of the percentage or the number of people that we contact that are resource users, and the license checks, the checks of their, ensure they got their bag limits, they're using the proper gear, all those types of things. We get an idea of what the kind of the compliance trend is. And what we found is that over the past several years, with these high number of user contacts, that the compliance rate is going up. The violations
rate that we had 2 years ago was 8.5% of all contacts had a violation. 5.2% last year had a violation, and in 2010, 4.3% of those contacted had violations. So that's a pretty significant improvement in the rate of compliance. On the boating safety side, this is not just the troopers. It's something that we jointly do with the Department of Natural Resources, Alaska State Parks. They're heavily involved in the boating safety program. And although the enforcement side and the contact side is generally by those in the field, and they rely heavily on us to do that part of it. Whether or not the contacts have a direct impact on the number of fatalities, I don't know. But I can tell you that the trend is going down in the sense that in 2011 we had 11 recreational motor fatalities, and 2009 it was 12, in 2008 it was 14, and 2007 it was 17. And I would hope that because we're out there checking and we're ensuring people have PFDs and things like that, that that's having the impact that we're seeing. I think it does. I've outlined it. I don't need to go through these, but on the bottom, I've given you several examples of some pretty significant cases that AWT troopers have worked. The first two were very significant. The top one was most accurate term was a bandit guy that had been operating for a lot of years in the state. And not only is he spending 700 days in jail, he lost his two airplanes that he'd been using to do his illegal guiding activities, but he's been banned for life for any hunting in Alaska. And as a matter of fact, I believe the judgment said that he's banned for life for any hunting activities anywhere in the world. I don't know whether that's enforceable, but that's what I'm saying. On the fire and life safety side of residential fire deaths, accounted for all the fire deaths that occurred in Alaska. This is one area where there seems to be an area for improvement. But the number of fire deaths for 2010 was 12, and then I've got the numbers there listed so you can see the prior years as well, so you can see what the trends are. A lot of activity in the Division of Fire and Life Safety, particularly in the area of building inspections and plan reviews, and these are primarily for commercial buildings and commercial type properties.
Yes, Representative Holmes, you have a question.
Commissioner, sorry to interrupt, but I was just wondering, the fire deaths, I was just curious, what are those? Do those tend to be people out fighting fires? Are those in homes? Do we have any idea of how people are dying in fires?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, all of these deaths are residential, from residential fires. None of them are firefighter deaths. They're all victims that were killed in those homes. I don't have a breakdown, for example, how many may have been smoking related or maybe heating system related or that. If you wanted those, we could get them. But,
thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Back on the number of inspections, in 2009, between 2010 and 2009, we increased the number of these building inspections by 23%. I'm not sure if your handout shows 23%. I had one that had an error on it that said 7. So if you said 7, that was an error. It's an increase of 23% over the previous year. Plans reviewed is an 11% increase. And we're working very closely with deferred jurisdictions so they can do those plans or those reviews and inspections. And what that is that we don't have the resources and we're not able to do all of the inspections that should be done across the state. So most of the major jurisdictions, such as Anchorage and Juneau and Fairbanks, have accepted deferred jurisdiction where we give them, where we have them do those inspections, and they are doing a fantastic job in those as well. There's a couple of Well, one thing I wanted to do is point out that the Training Bureau in Division of Fire and Life Safety has been very active on a couple of new programs that are interactive for kids to be involved with. And one of those is a new app also that they put that's available for your iPhone. So they're being very proactive in fire and life safety to take advantage of some of the new technologies and the methods that kids are using now to communicate as a method to try to get the fire safety message out to them. Statewide Services, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this one, but basically Statewide Services is a section of the department that has our records and information system, our APSIN, public safety information, has our sex offender registry, has our background investigations section, our fingerprint backgrounds, permits and licensing, concealed handgun permits, and sex offender registry, all out of this area. We've been doing a lot of work in Statewide Services in the area of enhancing our capabilities to interface with other agencies and other departments within the state with our computer systems and with our records. We have the APSIN project, which is near completion or in the sense that we can get off of the state mainframe and get onto a server, which will allow us to do a lot of these interfaces and crosstalks. Once that happens, our efficiency rates and the other departments' efficiencies will be able to be realized. We also have one successful thing I wanted to point out that was done in this area. We're continually looking at ways that we can internally improve, not only in the processes but also in our service to the public. One very significant service that this section provided is fingerprint background investigations. There's a lot of entities that require fingerprint backgrounds in order for employees to be hired, particularly in the areas that deal with contact with children, some in the healthcare field, schools, teachers, so on and so forth. We, not real long ago, had an extreme backlog, 13,000 in this area, that we're trying to move these through with a very bad, and we all admit, a very bad, dismal service rate. 150 days it took some of these to get turned around and sent back. That's absolutely, it's embarrassing, absolutely embarrassing for us that it actually got that bad. Through some redesign of our business processes to reallocation of resources on a short-term basis, we're able to knock that backlog off. We utilized IT and changed and automated some parts of it, particularly in letters and things like that. So we're able to turn that around from the worst that we had, which was 150 days, to what we're currently experiencing, which is about 3 to 5 days. So a very, very good improvement of services to the citizens of the state.
Mr. Chairman, may we interrupt with kudos on that?
Yes, we may. Thank you very much.
We'll make sure we pass those to the people that did the work. Thank you. We'll touch briefly on the Office of the Commissioner, some things that we've been trying to do, which also relates to internal accountability and efficiencies, is trying to ensure that we're responsive to complaints from the public. One thing we've done is 2 years ago we started looking at the establishment of the Office of Professional Standards within the Commissioner's Office. It was fully active this year, and that office is comprised of two investigators. They do all of the internal investigations in the department, and these investigators are external of the divisions, which means that they don't come from within the Division of Alaska State Troopers or the Division of Wildlife Troopers or any of the divisions. So they're investigations that are conducted out of our office. We also augmented their capabilities with a computer tool, not necessarily a system, but a computer tool that will allow us to not only better track the types and numbers of complaints coming in, but also the disposition of those. So we can immediately see what kind of complaints we're getting, who we're getting them on, who's lodging them, what they're for, but also how we're responding to those complaints, are we getting back to the people that are complaining, and so on and so forth. So we've got that in place as well. We implemented on most all of our main web pages a push button for the ease of the public, so they can, if they want to complain against a department employee or even give a kudo on a department employee, they can hit that button and take them to a page. They can fill out a very simple form. They can hit send, and it'll go directly to our Office of Professional Standards. So it bypasses any perceived choke points, or bypasses if people perceive that they may be complaining locally but there's nothing being done, or sometimes people will complain that they feel things get swept under the rug, things like that. That bypasses all of that and gives the public the ability to make sure that if they fill one of these out, it goes directly to this office. Crime Detection Laboratory. I want to move quickly onto this one because I know you probably have questions, and I know that we're backing up into the time of the court system. I certainly want to make sure they have time to address you. Crime Detection Laboratory. Now, first off, I'll start with just a real quick update on where the new lab is. As most of you know, a appropriation was made to construct a new crime detection laboratory. That laboratory is on Martin Luther King Drive, which is on the new road, which is down off of Tudor Road. The exterior construction of that lab is mostly up, so if you have a chance to drive by there, you can see where the lab is located. You can see how much exterior is on. We're about 30% or so complete on the construction. We're looking at move-in and start-up in not this coming July or August, but the following July or August of 2012. Back to the current lab and things that we've been doing. We've seen an increase in cases that have been submitted to the lab by about 15%. We expected that, and we expect when we get the new lab open that we will see a significant increase when that happens as well. We know that there's a number of cases out there that people, that departments don't submit, and as we gain capabilities, we're going to see those submissions start to come in. We've improved the turnaround time of those that we actually have been working. From last year, we had about 70% that we could turn in 30 days or less. This year, we bumped that up to about 78%. The other real significant improvement and success at the lab is the reduction of the backlog cases. We had significant or major case backlogs that a short time ago went back to the early 2000s. This year, we were able to, just recently, able to kick over the point where our backlogs are now 2009 cases or more recent. So last year we were working 2008, 2007, and before that we were in the 2006, 2005, 2004 cases. So we've made a very significant dent on the number of backlog cases, which is very significant to police departments and prosecutors. We also have a very quick turnaround time on our DNA CODIS database samples, which is very important because that provides the samples that are compared against when we have DNA samples submitted to the lab to try to identify suspects in cases, and most often those cases are going to be assault cases or sexual assault cases. And this past year we had 71 database hits. That means that 71 samples that were submitted for analysis hit against a database sample. So what that basically in real terms means is that we're able to identify a suspect in a case for a police department or a law enforcement agency to follow up on. I talked fairly quickly and gave you a lot of information. There's a lot of information also contained in the overview that I've given you that we didn't necessarily touch on. If you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer those for you.
Any questions from committee members? Mr. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions in three areas. First, you mentioned that the Highway Patrol is federally funded. and I thought you said there are 27 dedicated troopers for that. Tell me about the federal funding. For how many years will that be, and then what happens?
Okay. I'm through the chair, Representative Greenberg. Every year there's federal funding that comes into the state for highway safety efforts. Money is currently brought into the state through the Department of Transportation's Alaska Highway Safety Office. That office traditionally has put out for solicitation for departments to apply for that federal funding for their projects, for their highway safety projects. That is the funding mechanism by which we applied to DOT, AHSO, or Alaska Highway Safety Office, to fund the Bureau of Highway Patrol. The decision to continually fund the Bureau of Highway Patrol positions is the decision of the Alaska Highway Safety Office. Mm. So it doesn't necessarily, although we may have a project that we put out as maybe a 5-year project or a 10-year project or a 3-year project or even a 2 or 1-year project, but it doesn't mean that necessarily that can't be funded beyond the life of whatever project we have. BHP, for example, was submitted to the Highway Safety Office as a 5-year project. And the idea in the plan was to build the BHP, or the Highway Safety Effort, dedicated troopers to a specific number, and then that project would end. We can continue funding, though, through the Department of Transportation on future grants from them as well. I'm not sure if I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, so I hope I answered the question.
What year are you into that 5-year plan, sir?
Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do, if I could, the captain of the Bureau of Highway Patrol, and the one that actually does a lot of the grant work, is on the line. That's Captain Hans Brinke. If that's acceptable, maybe we can get him on to answer more.
Yes, sir. Captain, are you on the line?
This is Captain Brinke. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Yeah, this is Captain Hans Brinke. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, you're asking about the future funding. We're looking at 2013 would end the first 5 years of the project with extensions after that.
Thank you. Second area, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you're encouraging high school kids at Mount Edge to become interested in law enforcement, possibly to go into VPSOs. What is the pay for VPSOs, and how has that risen in the last few years, and what are you doing to make sure that remains competitive?
I'm through the chair, Representative Grunberg. I believe it was 3 years ago we raised the base pay of VPSOs from $17 to $21. We also have a program with the nonprofits where if those VPSOs also provide probation parole services in conjunction with the Department of Corrections, then we can increase their wages even further. And most of the nonprofits, if not all, have taken advantage of that, and that raises the base wage of most of the VPSOs to closer to $23 to $24 an hour. We've also last year implemented a cost of living wage increase, which we come to the legislature for funding for, and our plan is to keep our request commensurate with the troopers, for example. So if the troopers get a cost of living allowance increase, then we correspondingly come to the legislature and ask for one for the VPSOs as well. So that keeps their base wage not commensurate with a trooper, but increases with increases in cost.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
You mentioned how many villages now have VPSOs?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we have 80. We had in November, we had 83 positions that were filled.
And 83 villages?
That's not, excuse me, I apologize for cutting you off, sir. through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it's not necessarily 83 villages that have VPSOs, because we've done a number of things with VPSOs. One is that there are some villages that have VPSOs that are very large. Some have populations of excess of 1,000 people. In some of those communities, we've placed a second VPSO position. In some of the busier communities that may have populations over 300, 400, or 500, we've also looked at placing additional positions as well. I would have to come back with you with a specific number, but if my recollection serves me, we're more in the range of about 65 to 70 communities that have VPSOs.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
Through the chair. Okay, so you don't have to come back to me. This is ballpark. You then said over the next X years, you're going to have X more, Y more positions. How many years and how many more positions?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, right, yeah. The long-range plan that we've put forward, if we can fill positions, mm-hmm. is 15 positions per year for which would now be 9 years.
I was thinking it was 15 positions over 9 years. Oh, it's per year. Oh, okay. That makes me feel much more sanguine. And finally, Mr. Chair, and this is something I am concerned about and I've shared with the two folks on either side of me. Back to your first page here, the ABC board. A few days ago, the administration introduced House Bill 125, which will move the ABC board to the Department of Commerce. And I know this is a legislative priority for CHAR, the Cabaret Hotel and Restaurant Association, which feels, and to cite their legislative priorities, that that they have a better working relationship with the other department than with your department. I don't see the language here, but I note that the ABC Board, Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, was moved to DPS under Governor Murkowski, and I am concerned. I'm interested in and that bill, by the way, which will impact your department and the jurisdiction of this committee, goes to Labor and Commerce. That bill does not come before this committee. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm taking a moment, possibly with a little leave, discretion from the chair, to go into that move, because it's an important move and it reverses something that was done when several of us were new in this legislature and the Alcoholic Beverage Board Control Board came to your department. It's going to reverse that trend. I think it came out of Commerce to you, and now it's going to go back to them. And I don't know if you feel you can comment on that or you'd prefer not to. I'll give you the choice to do either.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, thank you. You are correct. I'll take the liberty of correcting you on a couple of things. The administration didn't submit the bill to me.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Yes. And during the Murkowski administration, the ABC board was moved from the Department of Revenue to the Department of Public Safety, and then you're correct, there is a bill to move it now to the Department of Commerce.
Through the chair, that's yeah. not coming from the administration. Oh, okay, I see heads vigorously shaking side to side, not up and down. Okay, I am again more sanguine. Thank you, I don't know if we'll talk about this internally on the committee, but I was asleep at the switch when this thing was assigned. I am concerned that it doesn't come to this committee. It's obviously impacting your department, and if my door is open, and I'm sure others are, if you care to talk informally with us or anybody does, but I am fairly concerned about that attempt. I'll leave it at that. Thank you for your leeway, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, it's just a point of clarification that I wanted to... Can you explain the difference between the VPSO, and I also see you have listed the VPOs. What is the separation? What is their different roles?
Through the Chair, Representative Pruitt. Yeah, thank you, yes. This is your question is very good and germane because it's a very commonly misunderstood area. The level of and types of law enforcement in rural Alaska generally are Alaska State Troopers, municipal police officers, village public safety officers, and village police officers. And there is a very strong and big distinction between VPOs, village police officers, and VPSOs. VPSOs are hired under a program with the Department of Public Safety, funded by the state. The VPSOs go through 10 weeks of training in SITCA. That training includes 8 weeks of law enforcement related and operational type training and 2 weeks of rural firefighter training. VPOs, on the other hand, are not required to go to that level of training. Their level of training under statute it's a lot less, and I'm going to say it's either 40 or 80 hours. But it's very significant, significantly less than that of a VPSO and certainly that of a municipal police officer or trooper. VPOs are hired by villages, where the VPSOs are hired by nonprofits under contract with the Department of Public Safety. The funding sources for VPOs are generally whatever revenue sources that village is utilizing to pay for them. Oftentimes, communities, and there's about 105 VPOs that we know of in the state. That number varies greatly from time to time because turnover rates in VPO is extremely high. And they're also generally very temporary. So they may only work as long as the community has funding to have them work, or they may be shortened hours, or a combination of both. Generally, the training that is afforded to the VPOs from these communities is currently being conducted by the Alaska State Troopers through a federal grant that was received from the Department of Justice, I believe BJA, Bureau of Justice Assistance. And without this training that we were able to get through BJA, there would be no training given to these officers. And currently the training given is 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Any other questions? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We talked about the hiring rates, occupancy rates of the VPSOs, that you're having really good success in filling all the positions. I know a lot of departments have problems where they've got positions on the books, but they don't have bodies to fill them. How are you doing within the rest of the ranks, in the trooper ranks? Do we have our positions filled?
Through the Chair, Representative Holmes, currently in the trooper ranks we have 14 vacancies. And if you recall, 8 positions were added in this fiscal year, so 8 of those vacancies were likely created by new positions. So we're doing very well in the trooper ranks for AST. We've currently got about 7 vacancies on the AWT side. So parts of these are caused by movement back and forth. Some are retirements also. Some are people that decided or determined that they're not suited for the types of positions or they're going elsewhere. But right now the retention rate amongst troopers is very good. And we currently are going through a hiring process where we've got a narrowed pool of 8 that we're looking at hiring now. We've also got a lateral. These are new, with no experience officers, and then we've also got a process going called the lateral hire process where we're looking at somewhere in the double-digit numbers of potential hires. So very soon we're looking at potentially filling a bulk of those vacant positions.
Mr.
I just described.
If I may follow up, Mr.
Chairman. Go ahead, Representative Holmes.
So are you running, I know you had an academy recently, and I'm not going to embarrass her by calling her out by name, but one of my high school friends just graduated from the Trooper Academy recently, and we're all very proud of her. So I was curious, are you doing, how many academies are you doing?
through the chair, Representative Holmes. We do currently two joint municipal police academy, state trooper academies, which we call ALETs, Alaska Law Enforcement Training. We do two per year. And we've consistently done that over the past decade. We also do one, in that same academy, add our lateral hires near the end, because they need a very, just a condensed version of training. We also do a training class with the, sponsored through the Alaska Police Standards Council for municipal agencies to send folks. We do one of those per year, which is 4 or 5 weeks in length. And then we also do one VPSO training academy per year.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? The chair has one. I know there's quite an investment to train a VPSO officer, and I was wondering, what is that turnover higher, being in rural areas? Is the turnover pretty high?
Mr. Chairman, in the history of the VPSO program, the retention rates have gone up and down. Traditionally, it has been very high. More recently, as we started implementing things like, well, number one, a focus on the program itself as being valuable, an increase in wages, a focus on training and a focus on mentoring with the oversight troopers, the increase in number of village visits that troopers are doing in communities that have VPSOs, that retention rate is getting higher and higher, so the turnover is less and less. It looks like it's stabilized. With the continued increase in positions, we're quite frankly trying to figure out how best to measure that, to get an accurate way to truly see what our turnover picture is. But it does look like it's stabilized, or certainly a lot lower than just a few years ago.
Thank you. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up to the chair's question, are VPSOs simply hourly employees, or are they in the state pension plan, et cetera? Do they get other benefits?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, VPSOs are employees of the nonprofit corporation that we contract with. So they are not state employees. They are not in the state retirement system. They are offered benefits through their employer. And most of the employers offer health benefits. They offer a retirement plan, most commonly a 401k type of a retirement plan.
Follow up to that, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
Are they a member of any collective bargaining unit, any union?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, no.
Are there any further questions? Commissioner, thank you for your informative presentations. This committee looks forward to working with you and your department in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members.
Our next presentation today will be from the Alaska court system. And here to present for the court is Doug Wolliver. Again, a brief biography of Mr. Wolliver can be found on your desk.
This is proof that he did go to law school.
Mr. Wolliver, please come up and take the table and state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. And one of the major parts of my job is to work with the legislature on behalf of the court. And I work on bills that may have an impact on the court system. There are actually two of us down here on behalf of the court. The other one is our deputy director, Chris Christensen. Chris works on budget issues. I work on substantive bills. This is my 15th session doing this for the court. I think this is Chris's 200th or something like that. I think this is his 28th year living in the Driftwood Lodge. So
I think for the record, Mr. Cherry came over with Vitus Bering.
But he and I have worked for the court together for a number of years. And today I'm going to provide you with an overview of the court system, which is one of the three parts of the judicial branch of government. I'm also going to talk about kind of how the court interacts with the legislature and how it interacts with the legislative branch. Like the legislature, as you know, the court system is a very small part of our state system in terms of money. We're about less than 1.5% of the budget, which I think is a little bit more than the legislature, but not a lot. Also, like the legislature, we're much smaller than a great number of executive branch agencies. But like you, as a branch, we have our own kind of internal administration. We have a series of lawyers. We've got a human resources division. We've got a fiscal division. We've got procurement, facilities, technology, all of those types of things. So we are a complete and internal branch, and we do things within ourselves. We're different than most court systems around the country. There are only 8 unified court systems in the country. We're a unified court system. A unified court system is one where there's just one state court entity. We don't have county courts. We don't have municipal courts and things like that. And related to that, we're one of only 5 court systems in the country that gets its funding exclusively through the legislature. As you would imagine, county courts get money from counties. Some courts get the money, get their budget from the people they fine. You don't want to get fines in those counties. Another thing that makes us a little bit different is our administrative director, who is the Supreme Court hires an administrator to actually run the court. The Chief Justice and the other justices spend their time resolving cases, so they hire a person to be an administrator, kind of like you hire Pam Varney to be the head of your legislative affairs. The Supreme Court hires Christine Johnson to be our administrative director. That's a constitutional position. It's in our constitution, and it's a non-judge position. And one of the reasons is judges tend to be very good lawyers. They don't necessarily tend to be very good administrators. So our administrator is an administrator. Although we're a unified court system, we do have 4 judicial districts. And we have always had them. The first judicial district is in southeast Alaska. The second district is in northern and northwestern Alaska. The third is south central. And the fourth district is interior, mostly Fairbanks, and then down south to Bethel and the surrounding villages around that area. We have 4 levels of court. We have a Supreme Court, a Court of Appeals, which handles just criminal cases, a Superior Court, and a district court. 5 members on our Supreme Court, and our court is not like the U.S. Supreme Court and many other state courts, which are cert courts, which means you appeal to them and ask them to perhaps hear your case. The U.S. Supreme Court accepts about 1 out of 100 cases. Our court is not that type of court. Any case that the court has jurisdiction over, if you appeal to them, we hear them. Some of them are huge and vastly important. Some of them are not. But everybody has a right to appeal. My colleague Chris Christensen likes to tell the story of the Supreme Court case of a domestic relations case where the issue before the court was custody of a chocolate lab. But the court still has to resolve all these cases. Everybody gets their day in court, and everybody can come there. But the difference, the primary exception is criminal appeals. Criminal appeals are handled by the Court of Appeals. That court was established in 1980 to take that criminal workload off of the Supreme Court. It's a specialty court. That's all they do. Our Court of General Jurisdiction, which is the court that can hear anything, is the Superior Court. We have 40 Superior Court judges in Alaska in 13 locations. And the most common types of cases they hear are felony criminal cases, civil cases in excess of $100,000, all domestic relations cases, child in need of aid cases, juvenile justice cases, and probate cases dealing with real property, those types of things. And although the Superior Court doesn't handle near as many cases as the next lowest court, which is the district court, the complaints your offices are likely to receive will probably come from the complaints about Superior Court cases. And one of the reasons for that is about a third of Superior Court caseload deals with kids. Child custody cases, child need of aid cases, delinquency cases. And for most parents, for lots of parents, the worst thing you can do to them isn't put them in jail. It's to take away their kids. And if it's in a custody case or a case where the state has taken custody away from them, there's usually a losing party, and that losing party is frequently not very happy about it. We get a lot of complaints about custody cases and divorce cases. And from those cases, a lot of good reforms come to or from those complaints. This body is frequently tinkering with the domestic relations statutes. Our court is frequently tinkering with domestic relations rules. It's lots of judges say the worst place you can resolve your family dispute is in court. Unfortunately, that's where a lot of those disputes have to be resolved, and it's an emotional area, and a judge is not a member of your family, and is going to have to believe one of you or the other of you, and frequently the outcome isn't very good for anybody. So those types of cases generate a lot of complaint. But although the Superior Court handles a lot of these very emotional cases, the District Court handles by far the bulk of all cases that come before the Alaska court system. The Superior Court handled about 21,000 cases last year, and the District Court handled 140,000. That's a court of limited jurisdiction. They hear misdemeanor cases, violations, small claims cases, and cases below $100,000, civil cases below $100,000. We have 21 district court judges in 9 locations, and we also have 43 magistrates in 36 different communities. And magistrates are a subclass of district court judge. While the district court is a court of limited jurisdiction, a magistrate is a judge of limited jurisdiction within the district court. Many of them are not attorneys. Some of them are part-time in small rural communities, but they hear a lot of violations. They hear a lot of domestic violence restraining order cases, lots of traffic, and they can hear misdemeanor cases and do hear lots of misdemeanor cases, but only with the consent of the defendant. And unlike other judicial officers, magistrates are actually just employees of the court system. We hire them, we fire them, unlike judges, and they're regular state employees. Between the district court and the superior court, the trial courts of Alaska had 162,000 cases last year. That's about a 5% increase over the year before. In the Superior Court, about 6% of their increase, increased about 6%. And within this group, felony increase was about 9.5%. Number of felony filings has gone up, with the exception, for some reason that I've never figured out, of fiscal year 09. Felony filings have marched up steadily, in anywhere from 5 to 11 to 12% a year, every year for years, and we're back on track with that. A 9.5% increase last year, and civil cases were up about 5%. The district court was up 4.7%, and 10.5% increase within that was for domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking orders, which we see thousands and thousands of. But our court's workload is only, it's driven largely by the number of filings, but it's also driven by the amount of work that's associated with different types of cases, and those workloads change over time. One of the biggest impacts that our court is experiencing, courts around the country are experiencing, is an increase in number of people who show up in court to resolve their case without an attorney. There are lots of reasons people do that. One, attorneys are expensive. And two, with the advent of the internet, there's a wealth of information you can get on how to represent yourself in court. The trouble with the court has is there are a lot more work when there aren't attorneys involved. There are lots more motions filed. In fact, last year, domestic relations motion practice in domestic relations cases was up 16%. First half of this year, it's up another 20%, and this just keeps going up and up. And it means more work for the court, because they do file, unrepresented litigants file a lot of motions. Unrepresented litigants don't always stick to the legal issues that the court actually has to resolve. They routinely don't have all of their paperwork in order. When you have a lawyer, you pay a lot of money for the lawyer, but they know how to proceed, make a case march through the court system. On the other hand, unrepresented litigants have every right to be there and have their case heard, and the court system does a lot to make that process easier. We have a family law self-help center which is so successful that it creates all kinds of work for us. But the Family Law Self-Help Center is a 1-800 number you can call, and they can help explain to you and provide you with a lot of forms for how to get your case through court. It's an incredibly important part of the constituency that the court has. But it is extra work for the court. And it's not just our court, as I mentioned. This is a phenomenon across the country. Some courts have dug their heels in and said, we're not going to provide forms, we're not going to make it easy because we don't want them here. Our court has taken the opposite approach. Our court believes that everybody has a right to access the court system. You don't have to have a lawyer to come in. And there are ways to make that process work for Alaskans. And so that's a big part of what we do. Another kind of different way we approach things in the court system is through our therapeutic courts. You'll hear a presentation, I think, in the next few days from the Department of Corrections, and you'll probably hear a lot about their efforts at reducing recidivism. Well, the court system also has an interest in reducing the recidivism rate of an awful lot of offenders. Many of the offenders who are most likely to recidivate have substance abuse problems or mental health problems. Our therapeutic courts started. We have a mental health court in Anchorage and in Palmer. Mental health court in Anchorage was started by Judge Rhodes, who is one of the nation's leading experts and one of the first judges in the country to start a mental health court. And the people who come into her court are people who do not generally commit crimes except when they fall out of their mental health treatment programs. They're minor offenses. And misdemeanor crimes, nonviolent, generally misdemeanor crimes, loitering, disturbing the peace. These are people with significant mental health problems that need to get back in touch with their mental health providers. And that court helps do that, and it's a whole lot cheaper than putting them back in jail again. Our substance abuse-related courts, our first court was started by Judge Wanamaker in Anchorage. And he started this court. This is a classic way how some of these things start. It didn't start from the legislature. It didn't start from the Supreme Court. It started from a district court judge who was frustrated with seeing the same people coming before him over and over and over again. And all these offenses were alcohol-related. And he thought, there's got to be a way to get this person off the alcohol so he's out of the criminal justice system. We now have a number of therapeutic courts across Alaska. They've been proven to be very effective at reducing recidivism rates, and it's much cheaper than putting people in jail. It's also a much more humane way to treat people who have these significant problems. But the work, in general though, the work of a judge is to hear the cases that come before him, which is a lot different than the job that you have. But there is one thing about what courts do is very similar to what you do, and that's our uniform rules. We have a whole body of rules that govern how the courts work. A small portion of those rules are similar to your uniform rules, in that they govern kind of the internal workings of the court system. How cases are assigned, who's assigned to what types of cases, how certain fiscal operations are handled, who has responsibility for what. What time of the day arraignments will be held in which courts and all those types of things. But the majority of our court rules are what are called the rules of practice and procedure. And those rules establish how cases move through the system. And similar to the legislature, we have court rule committees. Like you have subject matter jurisdiction committees, we have a civil rules committee, we have a probate rules committee, there's a criminal rules committee, there's a district court criminal rules committee. We have all these committees that propose rules and amendments to rules. And those rules then go out for comment, and then they're forward to the Supreme Court that has the ultimate authority to adopt or amend or not all of those rules. But we have a large body of rules, and we have committees that debate them. The rules of practice and procedure can and routinely are amended by the legislature. The Constitution gives the legislature the authority to amend court rules with a two-thirds majority vote out of both bodies. Frequently, they're very minor, and the court rule change has to be in the title of your bill. It'll say it has to be voted on separately, although frequently the motion, if the bill passes with two-thirds majority vote anyway, the motion on the floor from the majority leader is you know, you move and ask unanimous consent that the court rule amendment, you know, vote on final passage be a vote on the court rule amendment. So then one form or another, the legislature has to adopt those court rule changes. But bills impact the court through a lot of ways other than just by amendments to court rules. In fact, that's probably the least way that they amend it. Bills can affect the court in any number of ways. Bills can add new offenses to the criminal statute, which will mean more cases that come to the court. You can increase the penalties for certain offenses, which may increase the trial rate for some types of courts. You can increase the responsibilities of the court, such as you need to, in order to do this, you also have to do this and this. You need to send this information here and here. You need to start gathering this type of information. All of these things can have an impact on the court system, which is one reason I've appeared before this committee many, many times in the last 15 years. But nevertheless, the executive branch also is impacted by a lot of the bills that you hear through this committee. But our relationship with the legislature is a little bit different than the executive branch's relationship with this committee. One of the main differences is, although the governor's office or his designees will take positions on bills, they support some legislation, they oppose some legislation. The Supreme Court almost never supports or opposes legislation. The only time we do is either if we've asked for the bill, which we do every once in a while, or it's a bill that specifically addresses the court itself and its internal operations. And there's several reasons the court decided not to weigh in on your policy debates. And they've done this for decades. One of the main ones is the court recognizes that the legislature is the primary body that sets public policy. You do that through the budgets you pass and through the bills you pass. The court leaves that up to you. We don't weigh in on them. That's your job. Another reason is many of the bills you pass will come before judges for interpretation and they'll be and for constitutional challenges. And the court's objectivity can fairly be questioned if you're challenging the constitutionality of a bill and the court system's already weighed in committee saying, we think this is great. Well, you're not going to feel you get a very fair hearing before that court. So the court also doesn't weigh in for that reason. And then the third reason is, just like you disagree amongst yourselves about what's good policy and what isn't, so do judges. They don't agree any more than you all do. Part of the way I determine whether bills have an impact on the court and whether I should offer, you know, ask people to make amendments and things or otherwise comment on bills is I send them out to comment for comment to judges. I'll say, do you see a problem with this bill? And I'll get comments back. I'm not sure Section 1, you know, is consistent with this statute over here. Or I understand how it works in this case, but what about these types of cases? I get questions like that. And occasionally they offer editorial comment. And on a single bill, I may get two or three comments that say, this is a great idea, I'm glad they're finally doing it, and two or three comments that say, I can't believe they're even thinking of it. This is a terrible idea. So judges disagree just like you do. So there really isn't a judge's position on bills. But for all those reasons, we rarely say we support or oppose. My job will be to try to make your bill easier to implement in the court system. I can explain the fiscal impact. We submit fiscal notes if we think there's a fiscal impact. That's kind of my role in this process. Otherwise, we don't weigh in and say, we think this is a good idea or we think this is a bad idea. We also interact with the executive branch. We interact with the executive branch in a couple of different ways. One is just the day-to-day interaction with the entire rest of the civil justice system. We interact with Division of Motor Vehicles, Department of Corrections, Department of Law, Public Defender every day. There's faxes, there's information that goes back and forth. There's a constant communication between us and the other branches that are in the justice system. But we also interact in a more formal way on various committees. I explained we have the court rules committees that set up those court rules. Well, on all those court rules, like on the criminal rules committee, there are prosecutors and there are public defenders and there are public members who are in, you know, private defense counsel, the civil rules. We have people from the Office of Children, from the lawyers who do Office of Children's Services work, China work. They sit on all of those committees. We also have a terrific committee that's been reconstituted. It was reconstituted a couple of years ago, which is the Criminal Justice Working Group. Criminal Justice Working Group is co-chaired by the Chief Justice and the Attorney General. And then members of those, of that committee, are the commissioners of the various justice agencies, the Department of Corrections, Department of Law, Public Defenders on there, Office of Public Advocacy. All these groups are part of the Criminal Justice Working Group. And the Criminal Justice Working Group, its sole function is to solve common problems within the criminal justice system. One of the big problems we've had for a number of years is the length of time it takes for a felony to get from the time it's filed until the time it's disposed of. So this group has looked at that. So, well, what's the source of this delay? Where are the choke points in our system? Well, one of the major choke points in the entire system relates to discovery. And that is, you know, the initial investigation and arrest is done, all the information that's relevant to that case has to get to the various attorneys involved. And that's been a huge problem and a huge source of delay. So this group, working at the commissioner and chief justice and attorney general level, can set policy and say, okay, we're going to change that system. And so they're working on a computerized system where the discovery gets deposited electronically into a database that the other entities can access. But it's the kind of thing that this Criminal Justice Working Group does. It occasionally will come to the legislature for if a statute needs to be changed, but most of its work is just cooperative problem solving within the justice system. We have a similar group. It's called the Multi-Agency Justice Integration Consortium, but it goes by the acronym the MAGIC Committee. And the MAGIC Committee is a government at its very best. These are the people who actually work day to day on a lot of technology issues. Members of this group it's chaired by a representative from the court system, Division of Motor Vehicles, Corrections, Public Safety, all on this committee. And as you can imagine, within the justice system, there's a ton of information that flows back and forth. And there are a ton of problems with transmitting all that information. Ideally, you think, well, everything is electronic, it just goes electronic. But everything isn't electronic, and not everybody's system can speak to everybody else's system. And there are constant, anytime there's technology, people rather than me deal with it. I don't deal with it. Anytime there's technology, there are problems. And this group, all they do is they identify and solve those problems. And it's a multi-agency group. And I'm kind of stressing how we interact with this, because there's an important point, is that the criminal and civil justice systems are systems. They're composed of a lot of different entities. There are courts, Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, Public Defender, Office of Children's Services, Office of Public Advocacy, Division of Juvenile Justice, Office of Children's Services, Division of Motor Vehicles. All these entities are part of the justice system. And when you're in this committee, when bills are before you, it's important to always keep in mind that when you change it, a law in one area, you're likely to impact a lot of other systems. It isn't just you've made a change to how public safety does something or how public defender does something, or we've just changed this aspect of the criminal law. Just as an example, if the legislature gives more money to the Department of Public Safety to hire more troopers clearly means more cases referred to the prosecutor, which is more work for the prosecutor, which means more cases come to the court system, which means more cases get assigned to the public defender, and more defendants end up in the Department of Corrections. So the whole thing is interrelated, and change in one area frequently affects an awful lot of other areas. And also keep in mind that most of the participants in this system don't have any control over their caseload. The Alaska court system has to accept every case filed by the prosecutor. The public defender has to accept every case assigned to it by the court. And the Department of Corrections can't just say, we're full. The Department of Corrections is going to have to find a way. They have a variety of tools, but they're going to have to find a way to deal with every person that's delivered into their custody. So anyway, my point on that is, it is a system, and always keep that in mind. There's one other thing I want to just briefly touch on. It's not part of the court system, but they are part of the judicial branch, and that's the Commission on Judicial Conduct and the Alaska Judicial Council. Our branch has three entities. The biggest, of course, is the court system. The Judicial Council is a constitutionally created entity separate from the court system, but still related. And the role of that entity is to accept applications for judicial positions, you know, interview and review those applicants and then send names up to the governor, and it's from that list that the governor makes appointments to the bench. Also, very importantly, another important thing they do is they review judges up for retention elections, and they conduct an awful lot of studies of the criminal justice system. And then finally, the Commission on Judicial Conduct, I think they have two full-time employees. They're a very small part of our system, but that's basically the ethics committee for judges. And they enforce the Code of Judicial Conduct and make recommendations for conduct if there are violations. The Supreme Court makes the final decision, but that's the entity that serves as our basic ethics committee. So that's what I have for you. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have.
Are there any questions from the committee members? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, with some leave from you. Three issues. First, I'd like to touch on the very last thing you were talking about, the Judicial Conduct Commission. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has come out with a series of very important decisions, one of which I will focus on, that deal with free speech for judicial candidates. Mm-hmm. And they've held that it is an unconstitutional abridgment of judicial candidates' free speech if they're prohibited from freely speaking out during their, in that case, campaigns for re-election. Of course, we don't get elected judges in this state. We don't do that, and I fully support our system. Are there any issues not limited to that commission and its work that you would like to mention to this committee involving potential problems that judges are facing in their exercise of constitutionally protected speech?
To the chair, Representative Groom, but not none that I know of.
Okay. Secondly, there was a bill that was in, I'm not sure if it was the last legislature or not, to give either Anchorage or the Third Judicial District another Superior Court judge. Tell me about that bill. Was it enacted? What's the status? Is there still need for it if it wasn't enacted? I don't remember anything more than that, Doug.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that bill made it through the Senate last year, made it out of this body, but it died in House Finance in the last days of the session. We have introduced a bill. It's, you know, our bills, when the court system does ask for a bill to be introduced, and it's not very common, we can go several years without doing it, but when we ask for a bill to be introduced, it goes similar to a governor's bill. It's through rules by request, and the House bill has yet to be introduced, though I've had a request into rules, and the Senate bill was introduced, and I have a hearing next week in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and this time we're asking for two judges just to account for the increase in case filings from last year.
Through the chair, follow up.
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Are those two judges for Anchorage or what?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there are two judges for Anchorage, and they will sit on the civil bench.
Okay. You said that you've asked to have it introduced, but it hasn't been yet. Are you concerned about the delay in getting it introduced, or is that proceeding apace?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think it's proceeding apace. I went in and spoke with the office, and it's just it's been transmitted, and hopefully it comes back quickly. So I don't see a problem.
I hope that you'll keep in touch if there's a problem. If I may follow up a bit. In some states like California, they have unified the, in that case, Superior Court and Municipal Court, equivalent to District Court. What do you think about looking at that in this state? Not down to the magistrate level, but above the magistrate level.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't think the Supreme Court at this point is interested in that as an option.
Do you see any potential for doing that in the future, or is that something that they're just philosophically opposed to?
I could through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. I don't believe that this time the court sees a benefit from that approach.
All right, I'll leave it at that. And finally, if I may, on the difference.
Your final question?
What's the final subject?
Okay.
I've got a lot of judges.
We have some other people wanting to ask questions.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Well, maybe, okay. Do you want me to defer to them? Because it's a.
No, you're following up with the subject you're on. Go right ahead, Representative Gruenberg.
We all received a packet of grants that are about to lapse from across the state. This was, I think, from the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. And I went through that last night. And I would commend it to the other members because there's stuff in your districts, I'm sure. One of them, and I'd have to look at it, Mr. Woolover, was a grant for the therapeutic courts that had money still left that was unexpended. Does this ring a bell with you? Because if not, I can show it to you from in my office.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that one doesn't ring a bell, but I can find out about it, or I can
talk. If you want to, stop by, and I'll show it to you. Thank you. I don't remember how much it was.
Chair recognizes Representative Kelly. Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, thanks, Doug. That was a really good overview. I was really interested in your description of the committees, and I think I heard you say that they're made up of the court committees are made up of attorneys. Would you talk about a little bit more about that? I mean, how often do they meet, and how many are there, and just who are they? I mean, and who appoints them? You don't have to get in great detail, but just a little bit more information would be helpful.
To the chair, Representative Keller, members are appointed by the Supreme Court. They're, in terms of when they meet, it varies a lot depending on the committee. I think the Civil Rules Committee meets a lot more frequently than the Probate Rules Committee. I believe all of the members on the committee are attorneys or judges, but all of them are kind of subject experts. So in the Criminal Rules Committee, for example, you'll have district attorneys and public defenders and judges who sit on a criminal calendar. And the same in the Probate Committee is made up of attorneys who practice probate law and judges who sit on probate cases, and district court criminal rules or district court judges with people who practice in district court areas. I can get in the back cover of our court rules book is a list of all of the committees and all of the members on those committees, and I would be happy to provide that to you.
Just a quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
Do you know right off the top of your head how many of these people that serve on the committees work for the executive branch? And if there are any that work for the legislative branch, it might be hard to find experts in the legislative branch, but I'm very interested to know how many are already in the Department of Law, just to understand the system of it. Thank you.
I'll get you that list through the chair.
Thank you.
Any other committee questions? I have one. I noticed that you're showing quite an increase in cases that the courts are having to handle, but if you listen to public safety from the state troopers, they have a little less crime being happening there. Is it a lot more crime happening in the urban areas, and the municipal police departments are doing their job, basically? Is that where more of the court cases are coming from?
Mr. Chairman, it varies. One thing that's been kind of curious for a number of years is crime rates are generally going down in most categories in most areas. Case filings are frequently going up. And part of that, though, is there are staffing issues. A couple of years ago in Anchorage, we had a significant increase in our property crimes. So we're looking through, where did this come from? It's just a dramatic increase in property crimes. I called over to the Anchorage District Attorney's Office. Well, they had gotten funding to add two new attorneys to their property crimes, their unit that prosecutes property crimes. So it's not necessarily an increase in crime. It's frequently an increase in enforcement efficiencies, more police officers or more prosecutors, things like that.
All right, thank you. Any further committee questions? Hearing none, Mr. Woolover, thank you very much for your presentation.
You're welcome. I'll see you again.
Thank you. All right, committee, our next meeting will be at 1 p.m. on Monday, January 31st, and we'll have an overview from the Department of Law, Criminal Division. And at 2:42, meeting is adjourned.